And joining us on Perspectives today is New York Times bestselling author David Baldacci. David is published his first novel in 1996, and the major motion picture adaptation followed with Clint Eastwood as its director and star. David has published 29 novels. You may remember last time we spoke with David, we were talking about his book, The Escape. This one is called Memory Man, and it's very different in the fact that it's a new character that David creates, and his name is Amos Decker. And we'll talk a little bit about that in just a minute. But again, I want to remind you that David is not just a writer, not just, you know, novelist. He travels a lot and he does a lot of philanthropy with the Wish You Well Foundation. And we'll talk about that just as well. David, thank you very much for taking time to be with us today.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you.
Now, as I mentioned, your first novel was published in 1996. For the benefit of our listeners, you know, might be curious about, you know, what do authors do? How do they develop into good writers? Or have they always been wanting to be writers? Tell us a little bit about your background before you started writing.
You know, I grew up in Virginia, and I was a little kid who always was telling tall tales and yarns and liked stories. And I was a voracious reader. I went to the library every week and checked out tons of books and read them all. And my mom bought me a journal when I was a kid and gave it to me, and I started writing my little stories down. I got hooked, you know, on pen on the paper, and kept writing for years. I spent 15 years of my life writing short stories when I was in high school, college, and law school, and practicing law. And then I tried my hand at script writing because I was interested in how, you know, film gets translated from a screenplay. And then I tried my hand at novels, started a few, didn't finish them, and then Absolute Power is my very first novel that I'd finished. And that's really the one that changed my whole life. But I've been a writer since I was a little kid and took a detour into practicing law just because I needed to earn a living, but wrote on the side.
Interesting, David, as you mentioned, the fact that your mother bought you, I guess, a reader's journal so you could write everything about that and your stories as well. For the benefit of our listening audience, again, what did David Baldacci read as a young man?
You know, I migrated to a couple of different genres. One was fantasy, and so I would read Tolkien and Lewis Carroll and C.S. Lewis, and I also liked mysteries. So I was a Sherlock Holmes, and Agatha Christie, and I liked the Three Investigators. They were, you know, kids my age who got into mysteries and adventures, and so those types of books had puzzles and conundrums and things like that to figure out. As I got older, you know, my reading breadth expanded, and I would read John Irving and Ann Tyler and all the really cool Southern writers, Walker Percy, Truman Capote, Flannery O'Connor, Dora Welty, and people like that. And I just love to read, you know, no particular genre, just good storytelling.
Does that make it easier, or is just as hard to become a writer, as far as Norma and I were discussing the fact that it must be really difficult for someone like you to pump out novel after novel? And then after a while, I guess it becomes pretty easy for you because you started earlier, as you mentioned, as a young man and writing those stories. But what about the pressure to keep on putting out? Because whether it be a radio show or a TV show, people want to see something new, but yet at the same time, they're very nostalgic. So if you bring back a character, they follow that character loyally.
Yeah, it is kind of a balance. And I think, you know, writing is something that you get better at, unlike many other occupations, by trying things differently, getting out of your comfort zone, scaring yourself to see if, you know, you can really pull this off. And with this book, Amos Decker, brand new character, brand new location, and unlike any story or character I've ever written before. So this is a way for me to get out of my comfort zone. And I think you have to be true to yourself. You really can't chase what you think people want you to write. You have to write good stories that appeal to you, that you're passionate about. And I think people will come and read them just because, you know, the writing is better, the stories are better, just because you wrote them for the right reasons.
You mentioned Amos Decker. Of course, that's your new character that you introduce in Memory Man. Tell us about Amos.
He was a football player for exactly one professional play, and he was leveled on the field on a kickoff and almost died. And that brain trauma changed the way his brain works. So now he has hyperthymesia, which is perfect recall, perfect memory. And he also changed his personality because obviously the brain controls what you're like and what your personality is like. So he became sort of a different person. And he went on with his life. He became a police detective. And with his memory, was very good at it, as you can imagine. And then one night he came home from work and to find his family slaughtered. And that sent him into a downward spiral. He became homeless, lost his job. And he sort of pulled himself out of that, became a private investigator. And a year and a half after the murders, a guy walks into the police department and confesses to them. So that brings all of that nightmare vividly back for him.
When he's remembering all of this, in some episodes of the book, I remember where he sees certain colors. Do those colors, are they attributed to a certain way of the function of the brain, a certain time, day, anything like that?
That's the element of synesthesia. So you have sensory pathways in your mind. Those sensory pathways were mingled. So he will, for instance, see numbers and color. They represented as color for him. You'll have some musicians who, when they hear certain notes and certain sounds, they'll associate those sounds with color as well. So that's just a mingling of your sensory pathways. And the brain trauma that affected him and gave him perfect recall also rerouted and commingled some of his sensory pathways.
This detective, he's a retired detective, he's a PI now, but he gets an opportunity to work with his former partner, and it seems like they start clicking again.
Yeah, they do. I mean, he's a very quirky guy, and she has to learn to deal with that. But they were good partners over the years. She brings a balance to him that, you know, he otherwise lacked. And he was a little bit rusty at first during the investigation, but all of a sudden, you know, he got his confidence back, and he got back into his routine. And he just sees the world differently. He looks at what we all see, but he pulls different things out of it that allows him to be very successful doing what he does.
David, what about your research? Because obviously you had to do a lot of research to find out about this condition and how it works. And even though it's fiction, you know, a lot of your novels are very real. It's like this could be happening right now. So did you have to do a lot of research before you sat down and created this character?
I did. I mean, I spoke with people who know about the field. I talked to people who have various levels of autism on the spectrum, people who have Asperger's. Many of them also have very perfect recall in certain instances, also lack certain social cues and social skills, like Amos Tucker does. Read a lot of books, a lot of literature, went online and watched videos of people who have these conditions and talked about them, what their experience is like and how it had changed them. So I had a real, you know, a good foundation and amalgam of different research that I was able to bring to bear in creating and crafting Amos Tucker's character in a way that I thought was very plausible and very real.
Now, when you're talking about, you know, investigating and finding out about these people, how they work, what they do, because even if it's a police detective, there will probably be a detective out there who picks up one of your novels, reads it, and he or she will say, this isn't the way they do it. Or, you know, I caught myself, and you probably have yourself too, watching a movie, and they portray something, and you go, that is so Hollywood. That's not the way it's really done. That's not the way we writers work. That's not the way a film producer or lawyer works. So you have to make sure that you present what the public wants, but also that it's accurate.
Yeah, it is. And obviously, I think that people have gotten a very sort of jaundiced perspective from how they think crimes are investigated in this country. You know, it's not CSI where you can bring to bear all this cutting-edge technology and the investigators only have one case to work on. So police departments are strapped for resources. Sometimes the training is not the best. They don't have the equipment they need. They've got a backlog of cases. So they can't obsessively, you know, work over one case and as we found out over the years, you know, people are not perfect either. And, you know, you get case after case now where there was just a story yesterday where, you know, before the year 2000, the FBI admits that, you know, tens of thousands of cases that sent people to prison on hair analysis were flawed, or the DNA tests were run incorrectly, or fingerprints and tool marks were done incorrectly. And, you know, you got bodies lying in morgues around the country, and they don't have enough time to do autopsies on them. And so it's not as perfect as you would think watching it on TV or film. And I try to bring some of that out. It's, you know, human beings are doing this stuff. Some are better than others. You know, mistakes are made. So it's not a perfect road by any means.
We're speaking with David Baldacci, New York Times bestselling author. His latest book is Memory Man, and it's about Amos Decker, who is a pro football player, as you mentioned, for one professional play. Then he became a police detective, and then tragedy struck, and his whole family was wiped out, and he just got real depressed, spiraled down. But now he's back because the guy that they think may have been responsible for this shooting is in jail, and one of the things that comes out, because you mentioned CSI and some of the DNA and all the stuff that goes on today, in your book, you point out that with the technology that we have today, they can even see, like I think they talk about the young lady there, one of the victims, that she had had breath mints before she was killed.
Yeah. It's, you know, the technology is there, and it's come a long way. And they can do some amazing things. But, you know, at the end of the day, really most investigations live or die just on the tenacity of the investigator, going over mundane details, matching stories to see what doesn't make sense. And that's what Amos Decker is sort of brilliant at with his memory. Just because, you know, he remembers everything doesn't mean that what he's been told is true. So he mentions in the book one time where if he's been told a statement, the only reason he can figure out that it's a lie is if he's told or sees or hears something else down the line that's inconsistent, then he can pull that frame back up in his head. And while we sort of fumbling for notes, he can just pop it back in his head and compare the two and realize that, you know, the first statement he was told was a lie. And that will further him in the investigation. So it's really just dogged police work, going over details, comparing stories, and just doing a lot of common sense approach. That's where a lot of the cases are broken.
You probably, you being the author, did this, and you know, and I don't know if this was your intention or not, but the fact that this man's family is brutally murdered, and he's a policeman, and a lot of times we think of, you know, the police, they go out and investigate other people's tragedies, but nothing ever happens to them, and a lot of times it hits very close to home.
Yeah, it does. I mean, his family is really the only touchstone that Amos Decker had to a normal life. This allowed him to be closer to what he had been before the hit than anything else. And once that touchstone was gone, he just crashed. And I wanted people to understand that, you know, just because you're a cop with a badge, you know, bad things can still happen, not just to you, obviously, but to people you care about. They're not immune or invulnerable to crime either.
We're speaking with David Baldacci. David is the New York Times bestselling author of various books. Memory Man is his latest novel. Before that, The Escape, The Target, The Finisher, King and Maxwell, The Hits, and we'll talk a little bit more about some of those books in just a minute. But as I mentioned earlier, before we started, David, last time we did an interview with you, you were talking about the Puller brothers, and one of them had escaped from prison. I think was that Bobby or John?
Yes, that's right.
Okay. And you said that at some point you may come back and write something about their childhood, what they were like growing up, because you make references to their mother being gone and references to their father, the general. And these young men are very close to each other. It's a very tight family, but there are a lot of secrets.
There are, and I deliberately sort of place that foreshadowing element in The Escape, because at some point with all of my series, I like to go back home to where the characters came from so that people can understand why they are who they are. So the fact that the Puller brothers' mother disappeared when they were young was definitely something I wanted to lay in The Escape so I could focus on that and explore that more in future books. So that definitely will be the case.
Now, when you're writing and you involve series or characters like the Puller brothers, King and Maxwell, and then in this one, Amos Decker, who is a new character, do you tend to go back to one of the other series, one of the other characters, or do you continue with this one, or how does that work?
Yeah, you know, it's kind of it's an interesting challenge juggling series. For the fall book, I'm writing another Will Robey. It's called The Guilty, and it'll take Will Robey sort of into his past. I try to think of stories that will gel nicely with certain series. You know, if I'm going to write a King and Maxwell, it'll be a certain type of story that will work well with who they are and how they've evolved over books. Different for Will Robey, and if I'm writing a John Puller, obviously it'll be different too. So really, I try to find stories that, one, if I want to go back and visit with a character, then I want to write a book about them, and I try to craft a story that makes sense for their particular character.
David, I mentioned that you are involved in different organizations as well, and you and your wife have the Wishwell Foundation, is that correct?
That's right, yes.
Tell us a little bit about this foundation.
My wife and I founded it about 15 years ago, and we fund literacy organization programs across the country, and we pretty much funded programs in all 50 states and counting to help people learn how to read, which is the most important skill they're going to have. Secondly, we have a program called Feeding Body and Mind. We partner with Feeding America, which runs all the nation's food banks. And when I go out on tour, they send these big white boxes ahead, and people fill them up with books, and then we ship them to local area food banks. if you're seeking food assistance, you know, the odds are very high that you are literacy challenged. So getting books and reading into the forefront, into the homes of those people, will allow them to really lift themselves up and for their kids to break that generational cycle of poverty. Over the last 4.5 years, we've distributed out over 1 million books to food banks across the country.
Have you been in touch at all or perhaps talked to someone who learned how to read through this program and they've talked to you or someone else has relayed their messages to you?
Oh, absolutely. You know, we have follow-ups for all the organizations that we help. We get reports from them, you know, how the money was spent, how it was deployed, how the programs work. So we get a lot of feedback, very positive.
And what are the ages that we're talking about? Are you talking about not necessarily just homeless people, but there might be some children in a school, and because of the budgets, they can only afford a certain number of books. And as you mentioned, going to the library, that is a treat for someone once they learn how to read and open that door that takes them to many lands, imaginations. They can become a police detective. They can become a pilot, whatever they want. It's endless.
No, absolutely. And we do family literacy, which sort of runs the gamut of ages. We focus mostly on adult literacy because there's very little government funding for that. The concept is if you've been through school and you can't learn to read, that's your problem. But a lot of people fall through the cracks. And we get sort of a double bang for the buck, if you will, because if we can help adults read, then we know that that's going to improve the lives of the children as well.
Does the audiobook or the ebook and the fact that books have become so portable, has that helped you in some ways or hurt you?
No, I mean, I think if we reached a broader audience, you know, tens of millions of people have iPads and smartphones and Kindles and all that. So I think that really has driven a lot more people to wanting to read because they have devices available to them. A lot of people get those devices because they're going to download music or do email and stuff, and all of a sudden they realize, yeah, I can read a book in here too. So it's been, for the most part, it's been a positive.
We're visiting with David Baldacci. He is the New York Times bestselling author of various books, including King and Maxwell, The Hits, A Short Story, The Finisher, The Escape, Memory Man, The Keeper. Let's talk a little bit about The Keeper. That's a different book.
Yeah, that's a sequel to the Vega Jane series, the first one called The Finisher, and that will take her through the Quag, which is this, you know, dangerous place that encircles her village of Wormwood. I got into the fantasy. I wrote The Finisher over a period of about 5 years. I've always loved fantasy. I wanted to try my hand at it, and I sold it under a pseudonym to Scholastic. I wanted them to buy the book for the book, not because my name was on it. The way the book is written, they thought I was a Brit from England. And so it's been great. I just did a tour through Texas, three or four cities in Texas, and all about the Finisher and the upcoming The Keeper. But again, it's getting out of your comfort zone, writing about stuff that challenges you as a writer, and certainly writing a fantasy did that.
And again, something that interests you, because as you mentioned, when you were younger and your mother bought you that paper pen and you started writing fantasy stories.
No, absolutely. We never know what's going to inspire someone to sit down and start, you know, writing stories. And for me, you know, reading was a really big element of that. And going to the library and discovering the world through books was a big, big incentive for me to become a writer.
You mentioned Tolkien and C.S. Lewis earlier in the interview. Do you feel that because of the movies that this has led young people to become more readers of The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, The Chronicles of Narnia, and The Lord of the Rings?
Oh, I think so. I mean, the movies are always going to attract a far larger audience. A book, if you look at the Harry Potter series, it inspired a lot of kids to want to go out and start reading books, which is fantastic. So I think it's been a plus when you can meld those two entertainment venues together. I mean, you can collectively, you can reach a far larger audience.
We're visiting with David Baldacci. He's a New York Times bestselling author of the latest novel is Memory Man. Tell us a little bit more about Amos Decker. As you mentioned, he finds his family has been slaughtered, and then that takes him into a tailspin. But then all of a sudden, there's an opportunity that perhaps the killer responsible for all this is up and around, and he goes back into playing the game, and some interesting things happen to him while he's doing that.
Yeah, you know, the guy that comes in to confess to the murder is a homeless guy who Decker, using a very clever tactic, is able to sort of sit down face-to-face, and he's trying to figure out, is this guy really the killer or not, or is there somebody else out there? And if he's not the killer and he knows some details about the crime, maybe he can lead me to the real killer. So, but, you know, it morphs from there into something else. There's a shooting at the local high school that Decker's also drawn into. A lot of kids and faculty are killed. So that's where he gets back into his detective mode. He goes there, he's given temporary credentials, he comes in as a consultant. That's where you see Amos Decker do what he can do, as he's sort of striding along the hallways of the high school and looking at the bodies, looking at evidence. And that's where you see really where he sees the world differently than anybody else there. And he can understand things and put them together into a mosaic that nobody else can. And that's where really Amos Decker is definitely on his game.
Now, his partner, Detective Lancaster, is she aware of all this, or did he just kind of give a little bit of what he could do when he was on the force?
She knows that he has a phenomenal capacity for observation and deduction. She doesn't know that he has hyperthemesia. She doesn't know anything about what happened to him. She just knows that he's excellent at his job, and they've worked well together over the years. As the book goes on, obviously, she becomes aware of what he is and how he came to be, but they make a good team.
And, of course, he's real because, you know, the way you write. But I automatically, especially the scene, the area when he walks into the store to buy clothes, and he is trying on different sizes, and then all of a sudden he comes out, puts his old clothes in a bag, puts them in the trash can, along with his gun, and then he's an instant lawyer.
Right. You can see he's sort of a chameleon, you know. As he says, he doesn't like interacting with people because, you know, his social skills have been diminished because of what happened to his brain, and he doesn't like to lie. He likes to do things, you know, just by the book. But so he comes up, his solution is, I will lie perfectly, you know, and that allows him to get through that.
And do his former colleagues, or perhaps maybe the younger ones, like, I find that in some of these novels like yours, Lisa Scottolini, Michael Connelly, people who write the genre that you write, that sometimes there's a big rift there between local PD and the feds.
And that can be, you know, in this book you get a little of that too. But I tried to make it a little more plausible that everybody is fighting for the same goal. And so, you know, you need to work together at some point and to collaborate to try to take this guy off the streets before he can hurt somebody else. But there is, I mean, there's always going to be some tension between the feds coming in and maybe trying to take over the investigation and the local cops not wanting to back down. At the end of the day, though, if you want to make it work, you just have to work together.
When you created Amos Decker, and as you mentioned, we have to leave our comfort zone once in a while. When you had that idea, did it come to you right away, or was it something that you slowly morphed in your mind as far as this is what this guy's going to look like? And if anybody imagines him with shoulder holster or anything like that, because he says, you know, that his pants go just right below his belly because he's a big guy. And then just the way you write beautiful narrative of him eating at the Resident Inn and anything else he does, is everything's big.
Yeah, he is. I mean, one of the lines in there is that he can, you know, scare little kids just by being. He doesn't have to do anything more than that. But I really wanted, it was important for me to show that there was a lot of baggage in coming along with what had happened to him. And it's really hard to overestimate the inability to relate and react to people, which he lost. He used to be able, really good with people, could do the small talk and the chit-chat and got the humor and all that, and that's all gone. And what an isolated experience for someone who can't relate to any of that. Because let's face it, chit-chat, small talk, venting, and humor and all that, it takes up, you know, three-quarters of most of our lives as what we talk to people about. And he can't participate in any of that, which has an isolating effect. And I wanted to get that across to people. Just because he has this incredible mind, don't think that he has a perfect life or that everything is hunky-dory in his world. He gave up a lot, you know, involuntarily to get the mind that he has today.
Now, David, recently we've seen a lot of issues where excessive force by police has been happening, and we don't know if it's happening more or just more are being reported. Does that affect you as a writer when you're, good cop, bad cop, writing the characters, creating the characters?
Yeah, you really have to. You want to stay topical, and you want to stay, you know, you don't want to be dated. And so I follow all that stuff. I'm a voracious reader. I read, you know, 3 or 4 newspapers a day. I go online. I suck in as much information every day as I possibly can just because I want to be informed. So I'm very aware of all that going on. And what I had mentioned earlier is that, the real world is not CSI. Some officers are better trained than others. Some police departments are better trained than others. Some have far better relationships with the citizens with whom they're supposed to be protecting. And so just one bad apple or two or three, if it's going to be something like a Ferguson or something, when you pull out your, and you think you're tasering a guy and you're actually shooting him to death, or you're shooting somebody in the back in South Carolina, you know, that's going to, people are going to see that, and unfairly or not, they're going to say, my God, you know, there is a huge problem. Yeah, there is a big problem. There are a lot of police officers, and by and large, most of them do a great job, and they're very faithful, and they wouldn't shoot somebody in the back while they're running away. But the extent that we have any who do, then that's a problem that needs to be addressed, because it's not like the consequences were minimal. Somebody died. So, you know, changes have to be made.
We are wrapping up our interview now. David Baldacci is our guest, and he is the New York Times bestselling author. The recent novel is Memory Man. Before we close here, David, I think our listeners would like to know, what is David Baldacci reading now, or what did you recently read?
I've got probably four or five books going. one that I'm, you know, that I like to read. My wife hates that. She reads one book all the way through, and then that's it. I'm reading a couple of books on actually Mississippi, because I find that quite a fascinating place. There's one that I've got that I'm reading on the road, actually. It's called Mississippi by Anthony Walton. And just his experience as an African-American in Mississippi, and then moving away and then coming back, trying to, you know, find his roots and discover some things about the state and sort of all the anomalies and things that Mississippi represents. So pretty fascinating read. On my to-read list, David McCullough is one of my favorite historians.
Yes, the Wright Brothers.
The Wright Brothers are coming out. I'm definitely going to devour that book probably in one sitting, and so I'm really looking forward to that.
I think you and I need to visit, because I'm that type of reader also, and my wife hates that as well, because I'm reading various books at the same time, but I love it. And so you're welcome to come visit us whenever you're in El Paso, and we'll treat you to some good Mexican food.
I appreciate that very much.
All right. We've been visiting with David Baldacci. David is a New York Times bestselling author. His most recent book is Memory Man. Perspectives is taped and produced at the KTEP Studios, University of Texas at El Paso Communication Building. Thanks to our engineer, Norma Martinez. Our producer is Dennis Wu. You've been tuned to Perspectives. I'm Louis Sines.